Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you, as usual. And, Jim, when you think of where conservative and even libertarian-leaning conservatives get rousing standing ovations, the first place that you think of is the University of California at Berkeley. But that's exactly what happened with Rand Paul addressing students there, giving multiple standing ovations, according to the Daily Caller, by the left-wing audience after railing against government surveillance and warning the students, your right to privacy is under assault. He says, I'm here to tell you that if you own a cell phone, you're under surveillance. No one should be allowed to invade your privacy. He said that he's going to go back to Washington and push for a select committee styled after the Church Committee of the 70s, which I'm sure will make a lot of conservatives thrilled, to have a bipartisan approach to fixing this problem. Jim, I think it's probably a little rosy thinking that a lot of these people would actually vote for him if he's up against a liberal Democrat. But the fact that he's making inroads with people that usually conservatives don't even bother to address is a great thing.
There's like three different kind of aspects of this dramatic appearance by Rand Paul in probably one of the most liberal communities in the entire country. Remember, you know, this is the guy who spoke up in Detroit not long ago, spoke at Howard University. So he's making very clear he's not afraid to take his message into communities that are not often receptive to Republicans. There's an asterisk, though, is that when he goes to these things, he doesn't often emphasize, you know, here's why we need to cut the government spending. Here's why, you know, he doesn't bring the traditional conservative message to these not conservative communities. He brings kind of his libertarian minded one. So when he was at Howard, he talked a lot about eliminating mandatory minimum sentencing and things, which are, you know, getting a little bit more of a consensus in the conservative world. But it's not like basically he goes to these audiences and tells them things that they're kind of inclined to agree with anyway. But maybe it does them some good to see a Republican saying this sort of thing and kind of dispel the stereotypes there. He's got a great opportunity with the way the NSA has behaved. I don't know how many folks on the right I speak for, but I want the NSA to be an absolute pussycat here at home, but a Bengal tiger on steroids abroad. I don't care if you're listening to all kinds of phone calls of foreigners. They're foreigners, okay? You know, the Constitution applies to us. What really has people up in arms is the idea that we American citizens who have committed no crime or the government has no reason to suspect us of committing a crime or of being a threat to the country, and they're vacuuming up all of our information anyway. So I'm with him on this. And it's a great little, you know, opportunistic way to go after them, and, you know, citing Dianne Feinstein there, really doing kind of an important work of arguing to liberals that the Democrats they have elected don't stand for anything they claim to. I mean, Barack Obama had no problem going after the Bush administration and the Patriot Act and all that stuff, gets into office and then puts the NSA into all of our email accounts and cell phones and all that jazz. Having said that, I can't help but wonder at some point, does Rand Paul start kind of playing to that audience, and whether Rand Paul's libertarian-minded approach might end up going too far and limiting the NSA and what it can do overseas. Certainly a whole bunch of Ed Snowden's fans seem to think that. And hey, look, spying on foreigners is why we have an NSA. It's when they start spying on us we have a big problem. Nonetheless, you kind of have to admire the brazenness and the style and the panache of Rand Paul going to the heart of liberalism and arguing about the failures of the Obama administration and getting a lot of applause for it.
All right, well, on to the bad martini now. And it's interesting, the president, in addition to his many celebrity interviews that we talked about earlier in the week, he also has a tendency, and every president has done this, at various times, they'll bring in local reporters. They come in, they get 5-10 minutes at most with the president. They're all excited they can put this on their local news broadcast. But one CBS reporter from Arizona who had the chance to interview the president earlier this week also got to shadow Jay Carney. And here's what part of what she reported from the White House lawn.
We started here shortly after 8 o'clock with a coffee with Press Secretary Jay Carney inside his office in the West Wing, and this was off the record, so we were able to ask him all about some of the preparation that he does on a regular basis for talking to the press in his daily press briefings. He showed us a very long list of items that he has to be well-versed on every single day. And then he also mentioned that a lot of times, unless it's something breaking, the questions that the reporters actually asked were the correspondents. They are provided to him in advance, so then he knows what he's going to be answering, and sometimes those correspondents and reporters also have those answers printed in front of them because, of course, it helps when they're producing their reports for later on. So that was very interesting.
Jim, let's ignore for a moment the fact that this was off the record and she told the whole story on the White House lawn to her entire audience. But the fact that these reporters are dutifully submitting their specific questions, already giving answers, this makes the briefing nothing more than a theater performance.
Very rarely do I question your selection of the martinis, but are we absolutely certain that this is an accurate and true statement, or that she is accurately describing this?
That's the report she gave.
Okay, because the reason I ask this, Greg, is that if this really were the case, that Carney gets the questions ahead of time, how could he be so bad at this? I mean, it's like an open book test, and he's flunking. He gets up there, and he stammers, and he offers these non-answers, and he always looks like, you know, I have nothing good here. So in a monotone, sneering tone, I will mock you for asking it. Hope that Jake Tapper doesn't burst through the door and take my lunch money and move on to the next question. Yes, you, the correspondent from Baruchistan. Yes, we have some very important foreign policy questions on that one. That's Carney's style. It's been terrible. It's been terrible from the beginning. You know, but Bill Burton, like they haven't had a good press secretary in a really long time in the Obama White House, and it never seems to catch up with them that much or much of a consequence in terms of the tone of the coverage or the, you know, the criticism they get. When you're doing an interview or you're booking someone to do an interview, it's fair enough to say, hey, I'm going to ask a question. I want to ask you about this topic. But to get the questions ahead of time, really kind of surprising, disturbing. And then the next thing is that, you know, somehow, like if you're a reporter, let's say, you know, Greg, you and I are, you know, mainstream media White House correspondents, and we know the new policy under Carney is submit questions ahead of time. So we do it. We still get crappy answers. He always will say, I'll have to look that up, get back to you on that. I have not talked with the president about that. It is just kind of mind-boggling that they could have this kind of policy in effect, and yet the quality of the information we get out of the daily briefing is so subpar and thin and most days really meaningless.
Jim, it appears your initial instincts may be right here. We're getting reports not only from Jay Carney, but from some very respected White House correspondents like Ed Henry of Fox News that at no time have they submitted specific questions for press office review before the briefing. So probably more developing on this in the hours and days to come. On to the crazy martini now. And of course, it's March 20th, which means there's 11 days left for the at least current enrollment deadline for Obamacare. And apparently, young people are still not signing up in the numbers necessary. Estimates are that about 25% of those who have selected plans, who knows if they've actually paid for them, are between the ages of 18 and 34. The administration wants it to be 40%. And here's the latest effort. With roughly 2 weeks left in the open enrollment period for health insurance, some groups are trying to sell Obamacare to young people in terms they might actually understand. Music, comedy, and cash. Young Invincibles, a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. that is focused on the economic issues affecting young adults, launched a sweepstakes last week where it is awarding a cash prize of $1,200, enough to potentially cover a year's worth of health insurance premiums for a young adult to people who download their healthcare app or submit a card in the mail. Now, this is from Hot Air, and Jim, you're quoted later on in the piece, so clearly it's legitimate. What do you make of the latest effort to make this hip and cool to young people?
First of all, you know, that was a $1,200. Well, that's great as long as you, you know, are on the lower end of the premiums. If you have on the higher end, if you pick, you know, a silver plan, you pick a gold plan, you pick on something that's a much lower deductible, well, actually, that $1,200 is only going to do you like maybe a month or two or you know, much less than that. So $1,200 to spend a couple thousand dollars isn't really that good a deal. A lot of, you know, we're finding a whole bunch of the uninsured are saying, hey, you know what, I'll pay the 1% of my salary. It's still a better deal. This is kind of ridiculous. But it kind of says, like, look, this is something the Obama administration absolutely, totally insists is a good idea. It's something everyone should have. It's the one thing in the world the government is going to mandate that you have to buy. And yet, you know, there are 40 million people in the country who don't have health insurance. And with this giant, complicated, expensive, headache-inducing, stress-inducing, premium-hiking, you know, reform law that gets rammed through on a party-line vote, oodles and oodles of these people don't want to buy it. So now we're having, like, raffles and stuff. And now, oh, you know, you can win $1,200. No, if this is such a good thing, why do you need to do this? Why do you need LeBron James? Why do you need to go on Zach Galifianakis' Snuffleupagus' show? And why do you need, you know, the cute cat gifts and all? You know, like, we all heard the old joke about the, you know, advertising executive who takes over the dog food account. And he completely redoes the packaging and he does everything. And he makes sure it gets a huge display in the front of the store. And he watches the customers go and pick the other dog food. So finally he goes up to the customer and he says, look, I just don't understand. You walk right past our big display. Why aren't you buying our dog food? And the dog owner says, because my dog doesn't like it. And ultimately, you know, that little anecdote or joke comes down, it comes down to the quality of the product. Most young people are looking at these premiums, calculating how much the likelihood of them needing health insurance a year, looking at the deductibles, looking at the co-pays, and saying, you know what, it's just not that good a deal. I'll go without. I've gone without this long. Now, the Obama administration may not like their decisions, but when once Obama starts saying, look, you know, this is more important to you than your cell phone bill, this is more important to you than your cable bill, for a lot of young people, it isn't. And even if you say, oh, well, it should be, people are not the way we want them to be. I mean, if it was, you know, this is what the new Soviet man was all about. There are all these constant government projects to build better people. Didn't we watch Serenity from Joss Whedon? You know, the dangers that come from trying to make people better when they are how they are. Only bad things come when the government steps in just to make choices for you. Why, you know, we think raffles are going to, you know, completely change this and change the psychology of people is beyond me. We are 11 days from deadline. They're not going to hit 7 million. Maybe they'll hit, you know, 6 million and change, you know. But it's not going to be the young people they needed. And the train wreck continues, piling up car after car.
Jim, if I were a millennial, and thankfully I'm not, but the way that they've marketed this is so insulting. From Pajama Boy to these keg stand and hot to trot ads, you get your free birth control and all that stuff. And now to this, it's just, I mean, there hasn't been a serious, sober case really made. Every once in a while they'll do that. But for the most part, it's just been this kind of pop culture shtick. And it's, I'd be fully offended if I were conservative, liberal, or whatever, and I was in the mid-20s.
Greg, I'm going to offer a really terrifying scenario for you. They don't know that this is insulting. They don't know that this is making them look like idiots because they actually are idiots. I'm hoping that's not the case. I have some folks who fit into the, I have some friends who fit into that range, and they definitely seem smarter and not likely to. Oh, keg stands. Well, I better make a several thousand dollar purchase. You know, I mean. But you know, who knows? We've seen all kinds of bad advertising, so. We will see. I notice that, you know, we're starting to see young people sour on Obama, but it seems like more driven over the sense the economy hasn't fixed. They haven't got the job opportunities they wanted. They were upset about the NSA type stuff. And just kind of this general sense of, oh, Nirvana did not, you know, I don't mean the band. Nirvana as in paradise did not take root once. But that identifies me as Generation X, by the way, while we're talking. The fact that I have to specify what Nirvana is. That they expected, you know, Obama would get elected and everything get fixed. And here we are 5 years and change later. And things are generally worse on almost every front. On that cheery note, see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow. Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Friday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.